history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories out there just waiting to be told, and we'll never know unless we take a little time to ask some questions and listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we set out on that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're always entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And you're not going to believe it when you hear him talk, but our guest today is 98 years old. We're sitting in the same home that he's lived in since 1949 in Merced, California. A veteran of the 84th Infantry Division in World War II and a recipient of the Bronze Star. John Parker, our guest today. And Mr. Parker, you didn't grow up around these parts. You were born in Arizona?
I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, a little village by the name of Levine, southwest 12 miles right up against the South Mountains. And we lived there until I was in high school, and then we moved to Tempe. But living in Levine was a very primitive. We had a farmhouse, and my dad farmed for cotton. We had very few amenities, outhouse back in the corner, no indoor bath at all. But that was the way we lived, and we experienced a lot of dust storms, and you've seen pictures of dust coming over the South Mountains, and we experienced that, and all the dust that would go through the house. I was so sorry for my mother. It was terrible. But we lived there. And then when the Depression came in 1929, and my father lost his farm. We didn't own the farm, but it was leased, and so the owners wanted the farm back. And so we moved to Tempe because my two brothers wanted to go to college. And so we moved there, and my dad got a job. I think he had a little pull from the former principal at my grammar school in Levine. And he got a job working for the county as a road foreman for a crew of people that worked on the county roads there in Phoenix, Maricopa County.
You know, you mentioned growing up there, and I think you used the word primitive for the amenities that you had there. And people today might not grasp this, but you mentioned the bathroom facilities. What about the chores you had to do? I imagine as one of the sons, you probably had a few things you had to do around that cotton farm.
I was the youngest. When my grandfather moved in 1918 from Harrison, Arkansas. He sold his hardware store there and moved with his five daughters and one son. That was my father, and they moved to Phoenix. We farmed there, and I was the youngest, and so I had a lot of chores to do. I was in charge of keeping the big iron wood stove in the living room where we all lived and bathed. In a big tub, and that was I had a lot of job. Chickens, I took care of the chickens and learned to kill them and dress them, pull the feathers off and all those things. And my brothers worked on the farm mostly. I was too young, and I helped my mother a lot in the house. Although my dad said, now we've got four boys and Nona needs help in the house. So we all learned how to work in the house. We learned in the kitchen and do chores and so on, except my older brother, he was the boss. He wanted to be the boss, so he didn't enjoy much of those chores. But it was good training for us.
You mentioned losing the farm and moving to the city, and that happened so long ago. I know it's just a part of your story now. But at the time, was that a big shock to your system? Was that a jolt?
Well, it was a jolt for us because the house we lived in were very primitive and had about three rooms and a big porch around on two sides of the house completely, and that's where we lived and slept. And when we moved to Tempe, when we left there, it was different, but the houses were newer houses. They all had bathrooms, which was a great surprise. Not a surprise, but It was a new experience for us. But it was an experience moving from a farm in Levine until we moved to Tempe.
And when you have older brothers like that, I know they toughen you up to some degree, and maybe you learn a few things from them too. Do you remember as a kid having this dream or ambition of someday when I grow up, I'm going to do this?
I liked mathematics, and so I ended up taking math and accounting courses in college. But I never really wanted to be like a fireman or that sort of thing. I sort of gravitated into accounting and bookkeeping. I had an older brother. My brother Miller ended up in accounting also. And then my other two brothers, they were farmers, and they helped my dad mostly when he was farming. And then they both ended up farming later on in life. But it was a challenge.
And how many of you four boys ended up in the military during the war?
All four of us. Well, and three of us were in Europe, and my brother Jim was in Air Corps that time, not Air Force, it was Air Corps. He was also an officer and ended up teaching in Illinois at an Air Force base, teaching aircraft mechanics.
And we're going to get into your own military story, but this would be a jolt to the system, too. You're playing basketball for Tempe High School in Arizona, and your parents tell you, oops, we're moving to California. That had to be a curveball for you.
Well, it was a real jolt, you know, and I was on the team at Tempe High. But there was a possibility. I had a good friend there, and his father was postmaster in Tempe, and I suppose it was a possibility that I could stay with them to finish out my year. But my mother and dad said, no, I think you should go with us, and so I did. But it was a jolt, and I've always been very shy. And then going from Tempe, where I was, into Stratford and Lemoore High, it was a shock because I was, you know, here middle of my senior year, didn't know anybody. Lived out in the country. I wanted to play basketball, but we bussed in and out and you know, and then had practice after school and that sort of thing. I couldn't participate in that, but I got along.
And for folks who don't know, Stratford, California is one of those places that fits the if you blink, you'll miss it proverb, doesn't it?
It does, that's right. Although now it's fairly close to the Naval Air Base at Lemoore. Yeah, there's not much.
Well, and you probably saw that base being constructed when it was an Army airfield during World War II, right?
No, I didn't. But by that time, I was gone, and my dad had also gone from the farm that he managed at Stratford, cotton farm, and then he had moved to Corcoran to farm on his own. He leased some land at Corcoran. By that time, I was working in Moore Dry Dock in Oakland.
But before that, you did go to school at Fresno State. And I'm curious, since I do all the football and basketball and baseball games and all that for the Bulldogs, those teams of the late 1930s in football that Jimmy Bradshaw had were pretty good. Do you remember anything about going to those games or watching them?
Oh, yeah, I did. We got them all. And one thing that we did, Stockton was our COP was our big adversary, and I remember we took train cars to go, the whole school, if they wanted to, could go. Yeah, that was sort of fun. My first year, I went out for basketball, and I was put onto the Frosh team, and then got my little letter. But then after that, I was so busy, I didn't have time for sports.
I can tell your memory's really sharp, and everybody that I know that was alive on December 7th, 1941, seems to remember something about that day. How did you find out about what happened out at Pearl Harbor?
I was in school. I remember the big announcements on radio and all that. But it was really a shock. You know, everybody wondered, what are we doing now? And I know a lot of people enlisted. When I was going to school, I lived with a family that had lived in Chowchilla, knew my brother. He knew that it was possible for me to live with them in room and board, so I did. I lived with them, and that was the whole family were talking about that. Everybody was.
How soon did you realize that this is something you could end up involved in at some point?
Well, I realized that because there was a draft system was on. They were drawing numbers and really didn't have any idea, but there's always a chance that I could have been called any time, so that was one reason why I didn't go ahead and finish my final year at Fresno State. I lived at this house, the Heises, and they had lived in Chowchilla, And then they had moved to Fresno. And while they were in Chowchilla, my brother was working for the Cotton Oil Company and lived there. So he said, I know a place that you might live when you go into Fresno State. And so I did. I went there and lived there for 2 years. And their daughter and I fell in love. The third year, my mother and her mother said, I think it's time for John to move out. So I did. I moved over to frat house and lived there and worked part-time for my room and board.
You left Fresno State because it was your brother's idea to go work on ships?
Well, we decided that I probably would be drafted, and he was about ready to join. He joined the Air Corps. And I took lessons in welding in Corcoran there at a machine shop. And he had already learned a little about welding at home. And so when we went to Oakland, they gave us a test at Moore Dry Dock, a welding test, and we passed, and they hired us.
Was that just an opportunity for you work-wise, or was that something where you felt, I'm doing this for my country and I'm helping the cause?
Well, I think it was probably both, because there was a great need for employees. You know, a lot of the people were going to the service. There was a need, and we had a friend in Corcoran at that time, and he was working for the same company, Moore Dry Dock, in Oakland. And so he said they had a dire need for welders. They're building victory ships and also doing all kinds of repair. And so we decided that at least we'll help out and also make a little money. So that's what we did. Because of our lack of skills, we started welding just flat, on the decks and doing flat work. But then we moved from that into repair work. We had ships coming in from all over Russia and France and needed repair. A lot of them were old, and we'd go down into the bottoms of the ships, and we did a lot of welding of rivets. They had been used rivets, and they needed to be welded around the rivets so they wouldn't leak. So that was one of our big jobs, and we ended up on the graveyard ship also.
Was your expectation that you would just keep doing that and not end up in the service, or were you kind of just waiting for Uncle Sam to say, hey, it's your turn?
Well, it was getting close. We knew that I could probably be called any time. So then we decided, Irene, who was the daughter, and we decided to get married.
So they told you had to move out, but they didn't say you can't date our daughter.
No, that's right. No, that was okay. But I was only three blocks away, so it was okay.
So you're drafted. You don't know where you're going to end up, but you have to know that your life could be in jeopardy, and you decide to ask her to marry you anyway. Was there any hesitation on your part?
No, I don't think so. We just loved each other and had gone together for a couple of years and decided that that's what we wanted to do. It was always a risk from her standpoint, of course, that I could be wounded or anything happen. So anyway, we decided to get married, which we did. I was married in the First Presbyterian Church in Fresno.
So you're married in January of 43, and when did you get your draft notice?
Oh, draft notice was about the same time, and that was for March, a little over a month away.
So a little more than a month after you got married, you had to report.
I had to report, yeah. We got a bus in Fresno, and it took us over to Monterey, Presidio in Monterey, and that's where we were inducted.
Was it hard to say goodbye?
Yes, it was. It was bad.
And I've got a feeling that she probably wrote you a letter or two during this time period.
She wrote me a lot of letters. And I, of course, wrote her a lot of letters. But I didn't save letters. She saved every letter. And I still have a box of letters that I wrote to her. I was in the infantry, and I didn't have any way to save letters.
But some of the letters she saved that you still have are letters you probably wrote in a foxhole or pretty close to the front lines.
Oh, sure, yeah. We would be online for a while, and then pull back, and then you had rest and relaxation.
You mentioned you ended up in the infantry, the 84th Infantry Division, but before that, you thought you were going to be doing something else in the Army?
When I went into the Army and I was inducted into the Army, they sent me and a lot of others from Presidio to Texas to activate the 651st Tank Destroyer Battalion. And we got there, and they had the cadre there, all the sergeants and the lieutenant. That was in northern Texas, Brownwood, Texas. So we took training there. Then we had advanced training down at Camp Hood. It was Camp Hood at that time. Now it's Fort Hood. And then we went on maneuvers in Louisiana. The battalion was all ready to go overseas, and they decided that they didn't need tank destroyers because the war had moved from Africa into Italy. A different terrain, different needs. So they deactivated our battalion.
And what were the things that you had trained for as far as the weaponry or the strategy that you guys would be employing?
Tank destroyers were actually an artillery unit. They were not on the front lines with the tanks, but were held back and line of sight fire. Whereas an artillery, they have a forward observer to see how you're doing, and tank destroyers would fire line of sight with the big guns. We started out with half tracks because they had not manufactured enough tank destroyer units to satisfy our need in the battalion. We trained with those, and then we got the brand new ones, and then we trained on the firing range and made a lot of noise.
I'm just assuming that your wife stayed here in California while you're going to all these places to train.
By the time that we got married, her family had moved to Bakersfield, and so when I went into the Army, then she moved to Bakersfield and worked for PG&E down there all the time that I was gone. She lived at home and then worked for PG&E in Bakersfield.
So you're with this tank destroyer battalion, then they say, oops, don't need those anymore, and now you're in the regular infantry. How did you feel about that?
We thought that was terrible. Nobody wants to be in the infantry, and so we were. And we went to infantry training and basic and advanced. From then, of course, we were not a unit at that time because everybody would become just a replacement. And most of them went to Europe. I don't think of anybody that I knew that went from there to Pacific.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, 98-year-old John Parker will share his first taste of combat with the 84th Infantry Division, some of the challenges he faced during the Battle of the Bulge, and the daring patrol that would earn him the Bronze Star. You can read the citation for that medal and find other photos of John at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 98-year-old John Parker of Merced, California. Drafted into the Army in 1943, he originally trained with a tank destroyer battalion until the need for infantrymen took precedence. In 1944, with his wife Irene back home in California, he headed across the Atlantic on the Queen Elizabeth, waiting to find out the unit to which he would be assigned.
Joined the 84th Infantry Division, 333rd Regiment at Geilenkirchen. We were in it's a small village, and within a few days then we had moved on and were living in German bunkers that they had built in the Siegfried Line. And then we were there until we kept moving on, of course, and whatever the 84th Infantry Division had to do. We were living in whatever conditions we ran across. They would, command air houses and everything. But also when we went over on the Elizabeth, we were discharged at the Firth of Clyde, which is northern Scotland. And then we went through the process of moving down through England, across the Channel into France. And that was kind of interesting. You'd be there for a couple of days, and then your name would be called, and then you could move on.
Was there a welcome to the war moment for you? Was there a moment where you realized, how dangerous a situation this was going to be?
Well, when the last move that we went in Belgium to a new set had been an artillery institution in Belgium, and we could hear fire and watch the planes, and we knew we were getting close to combat, and that's always in your mind. But one thing, when we did join the 84th Infantry Division, we joined a platoon. We were in 3rd Battalion, and it was almost comforting to join because this was family. Yeah, you know that you're going to be with these people here. And they were all glad to see you, you know.
Because before that, you don't know where you're going to end up. Now you finally belong somewhere, huh?
Now you belong. And that was a good feeling. It was a good feeling. That came probably from my background, because when we lived in Phoenix and my grandfather came there, and he had 5 daughters and my father, 1 boy. It was a big family then, and everybody got together at holidays. It was a big family, and we missed that a little bit when we moved to California. But family was a big thing in our family, in our life.
So when you're there, so far away from your real family, these other guys in uniform who you've never spent any time with before, they turned into your family in a hurry?
Yeah, they did. It was family. You're back to family again. I think that's why it was good, and it felt good. You know, here we're going into combat, and I'm enjoying combat unit, and yet it felt good because it was just family again.
And I'm sure that every day was different and unique and had its own fair share of challenges. But can you give us a sense, a template, an example of what the day-to-day existence in combat was like for a guy in a rifle platoon in the 84th Infantry Division?
Well, it varied. When we joined, it was getting into winter. They'd experienced, I think, that winter was the coldest they'd had in 25 years, I think. And so living out was terrible. And snow, and it was not good. The experience of combat, if people want to know, they can go to a movie and see what happens in combat. And it was tough.
Was there anything that you had done in training or anything in your life that prepared you for that feeling of the enemy shooting at you?
Well, you imagined a lot of what combat would be, but you always worried a lot about it, and of course you read about it, and you were trained even for hand-to-hand combat. We went through training in the infantry, and that's one thing that I never experienced was hand-to-hand combat. Fortunately, when we were sent down to work on the Bulge, the Germans were advancing, of course, as far as they could go. Then we moved there in the northern sector, and then it was the reverse. They had to retreat because the Allies were overpowered with not only men, but also machinery that was needed.
Well, a lot of questions come to mind because I know you faced a lot of hazards. But maybe let's start with the weather, because you mentioned how cold it was, and it's documented that was the worst winter they'd had in decades. And here you are, a guy from Arizona and California, out in feet and feet of snow. What did you have to keep you warm? How did you stay warm? How'd you survive that?
Well, we were supposed to get winter gear, and I'm not sure what that was, but it was always late coming. It was like the Army, you know, there. Uh-huh. But it was cold, and you had to live. We were outside most of the time, and I remember one night we had to move from point A to point B and spent probably 5 or 6 hours, and a whole company was out in the snow. And when you're doing that, you're not in a hurry because they have to move a little bit, and then you stand and you wait, and you're out in the snow. And it was, the cold was terrible, really was awful, yeah. And I had never experienced that kind of, living in southern Arizona all my life, I had nothing, no experience with snow.
Well, I'm just thinking about that and wondering how you avoided getting frostbite or having your toes turn black or losing some of your extremities. Were there some things you did to combat that?
Well, you try to keep them dry, of course, and then you need to even take your shoes and socks off if you're on a rest and you're not in combat at that time, and rub your feet, keep the circulation going, and it helps.
And when you say the Battle of the Bulge, I mean, most people think this big, monstrous battle where thousands and thousands died, and it was tragic. But I'm sure you're just seeing a little sliver of it. Was it not until afterwards that you realized how massive an operation that was and how many guys had lost their lives, or did you see signs of that as it was unfolding?
Well, you could see part of that because we were in one sector. We were on the northern sector of the Battle of the Bulge. All the publicity and notoriety really was from where Bastogne was, and Patton trying to reach there, and they were trying to live in siege by the Germans. But it was it wasn't good.
And I've got to ask you, I know some of these things are harder to talk about than others, but you mentioned that feeling of family once you knew your outfit, you knew this platoon you're going to be with. I have to imagine that you probably had to deal with losing some of those guys who had become your family. What was that like, and how did you handle it?
Well, that's just part of life over there. You expect that. And when I joined the platoon in Geilenkirchen, the day before they had a firefight, and the fellow that I replaced, I never didn't get to know his name. But, you know, you just learn to live with the idea that you might be wounded. I remember soon after I joined the platoon, we were moving from one place to another and moving through a forest. And Germans started sending artillery in, and we had tree bursts. And that was terrible. And we had soldiers yelling and people yelling for a medic all the time. And you could hear the tree bursts, and it was pretty bad. I'd become a Christian, and we were all a Christian family. But at that time, I said, Lord, we need help here. And but I came close to, I think, just breaking, but the Lord helped me through that.
And when you talk about tree bursts, some people might not be familiar with what that means, but you're in the forest, and all those trees around you basically become additional shrapnel that these artillery shells can create and spray everywhere. So you say, and it's dark, but you hear your fellow soldiers crying out in pain, asking for medics. And what did you do? Did you keep moving? Did you hunker down? How did you avoid getting hit?
Well, you can't, don't have time, and the ground's frozen anyway, because you can't dig a foxhole. No. And all you can do is you'll just lay down, and tree bursts are terrible, because when the shells hit the trees and they burst, the shrapnel can go any place. Your targets, if they're not tree bursts and they burst on the ground, then the shrapnel, none of it goes down because it's already there. So most of it has to go up or to the side. And there's always a chance that you can survive that.
But there's really nowhere to hide. And you just talked about it, what that did to you, that it almost broke you, that it brought you to a point where God was your only relief or your only outlet, the only person you could appeal to in that moment. And I don't want to harp on it and press on it and make it more than it was, but it sounds like an overwhelming moment for you that kind of is still there, that you can remember what that felt like. Can you help us understand what that felt like?
Well, you were people dying around you, people being wounded around you, all the yelling and, you know, for medic, and the medics were trying to reach everybody. And it was pretty bad. You realized that in an instant you could be gone or be wounded. But the Lord helped me through that.
And I don't want to put thoughts in your head or words in your mouth, but is that a situation where you think about that wife back home who you were only married to for a little more than a month before the Army took you away?
Oh, yeah. You miss that. Yeah, miss being home with family, and it was hard.
A lot of guys have said, you know, they carried a photo of their wife around, or, you know, something from her. Is there something you did to make it like her presence was always with you while you were over there?
Well, I had pictures of my wife and the family, too, and that always helped. And letters were great, too. Letters were wonderful. You're keeping in touch. Of course, now, wherever they are, they can call home. We couldn't call home.
I'm sure you would have loved to many times. And with the Bulge specifically, you talked about being on the northern part. Was that something where it felt like it was never going to end, or could you see the progress that was being made?
Well, we had reports. And, of course, like where you are, you really don't get a lot of news. It filters down to you, but some of it's good, some of it's bad. We were hearing also of the terrible things that were happening down in Bastogne, they had the massacre down there, and people talked about that. We were doing mostly moving a lot. And then when the Bulge failed as far as the Germans were concerned, then they were on the way back because they had to reverse and go the other direction.
When you say the massacre, do you mean the Malmedy massacre when they captured the Americans and just gunned them down?
Yeah, and shot them, killed all of them. And I think probably that changed a lot of the attitude of the soldiers, too. They were saying, no more prisoners, no more prisoners, you know. Now, how often that happened, I don't know.
You're hearing them say that, and the implication is they're not going to take any chances with German prisoners. They're going to treat them the same way the Germans treated the Americans.
Yeah, I'm sure that happened, but I don't know statistics whether they really have that down as record or not. I don't know, but I'm sure it went through a lot of minds that time.
And you told us about, you know, with those tree bursts in the forest, and you said that God helped you. When you say God helped me, is that just with your own psyche and your own mindset walking through all this? Or do you look back at specific moments and say, boy, that's pretty amazing that I survived and there must have been something else going on there?
Well, yeah, I think you fear for your life. That can be in the environment that you are at the time, and all the tree bursts and all the noise and the yelling, and it was pretty bad. But you trust in the Lord, and it helped. I calmed down, and then we moved on after that.
Are there instances that you look back on and you say, that was a pretty close call? I almost that one almost had my name on it?
Oh, sure, yeah. And a lot of times, you know, your firefights, you think about that, you know. But it's a risk. And you just live with that.
Not trying to be salacious here or anything, but just to understand, what would you say is the closest that an enemy round or shell or some piece of artillery came to you?
Well, probably rifle fire that was close to me. We didn't really get a lot of artillery fire. That was one of the worst ones that I experienced. But we did have experiences, I remember, and this was back to snow again. We were going, the hill was in front of us. And that night, I was chosen to be on a patrol to go up and see at the top of there if there was any Germans up there. So we did, and crawled up. We could hear the Germans talking and then we went back and reported. Then the next morning, we had one tank with us, and he started up, and then we were out flanked on both sides. And when we got there, the Germans were gone. But we didn't know that, of course. I think people would like to get behind the tank, you know?
Yeah, and it's hard to blame them. And when you say the rifle fire came close, are we talking a couple feet? Are we talking a couple inches? How close do you think it came to you?
Probably within feet, yeah, close enough. And you hear a lot. And when we ran across the tank destroyer unit there in Germany, he says, there's a German Tiger down there, and he's firing at him. I heard one shot, but they were terrible. You could hear those go by. It was pretty bad.
I have to imagine you heard the 88s a time or two, too, huh?
Yeah, heard 88s. And they're terrible sounds, you know. Yeah, it was bad.
You're not a very old guy at this point, by our understanding today. See, if you're born in 1919 and this is December of 44, you're 25 years old?
25 years old.
And you're probably an old man compared to the guys around you.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah.
I mean, if you're 25, there's probably some 18, 19, 20-year-olds around.
Yeah. And when I moved in with the company and the platoon that I joined, yeah, I was older. I was the fellow and I went to school with in France. He was staff sergeant. I was buck sergeant. I had three stripes. He had four. I think that I had replaced somebody, I think the day before, had been wounded or killed, and I was a replacement for him.
That is the reality of a replacement soldier. You're needed because the guy who occupied that spot you're filling is no longer able to fight. Time for another break, but when we come back, I'm going to read for you the citation accompanying the Bronze Star awarded to John Parker in January 1945. Don't forget to check out the photos and a short video of John at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we'll have the rest of today's conversation right after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, go into your heart, you just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
Veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the chance to meet an amazing 98-year-old survivor of the Battle of the Bulge. John Parker served with the 84th Infantry Division in Europe during World War II. On the wall of his home in Merced, California, you'll find the Bronze Star Medal, accompanied by the citation that describes what he did to earn it. And with John's permission, I'm going to read that to you. So this is from the Office of the Commanding General of the 84th Infantry Division, the Rail Splitters, Sergeant John M. Parker, 333rd Infantry, United States Army, for heroic service in connection with military operations against the enemy in Belgium, 15-16 January 1945. Although exhausted from a previous patrol during which he had gained accurate and vital information concerning the enemy, Sergeant Parker guided another patrol to the enemy positions. Encountering heavy enemy fire, Sergeant Parker, without regard for his own safety, routed the enemy from their foremost position and captured two prisoners. Shortly thereafter, Sergeant Parker captured three additional Germans. The courage, initiative, and aggressiveness displayed by Sergeant Parker contributed much to the success of his company's operations and are in accordance with the finest traditions of the military service. So that's what the general said about it. I want to hear it in your version.
We had received information that there were somebody out there, and so the lieutenant in the platoon designated the three of us, the staff sergeant, myself, and another fella, and we went out on patrol, and we had a firefight with them. There were two that we encountered, and we got in a firefight with them. They were both wounded. I don't think any of our patrol was wounded at all. One was severely wounded, then one we took back, practically carried him back because he was a source of information, and they wanted to interview him, talk to him. But the other one was not, he didn't make it, but we did save one.
And that was the first patrol or the second?
That was the second patrol.
But you had gone out the night before, and the citation describes you as being exhausted from that. Can you put into words how exhausted or what that's like? I mean, yeah. Did you get any rest?
Of course, you don't get much rest anyway. When you're out on the line, you know, you're in foxholes, and you don't get a lot of rest. And so then you'd been out in your tents because you're out on patrol. That's what he's referring to, that we were mentally strained and also physically tired.
So then they asked you to go back out, or you volunteered to go back out?
They asked us to go back out. Not supposed to volunteer.
I've heard a lot of guys say that, never volunteer for anything in the Army. That's the first rule. So when they say, we want you to go back there and take us to where you were, is there part of you that doesn't want to do that?
Not really, but you do what they say.
And how many guys were with you?
There was only three of us.
So there's three of you, and it says that you led them back to that enemy position, and you routed the enemy, and then you captured two prisoners, and then you captured three more. So it sounds like they had you outnumbered.
Well, they did, but I don't know why that happened, but it did. It was hard. And I don't think we didn't get wounded at all. But we had fired at these two in the second patrol and wounded both of those.
Were you firing at some others, too, that were in the area that probably ran away? Or?
Well, no. I don't know why there was only two people there. Maybe they had had a firefight someplace else.
Well, and then it says that on the way back, you encountered three more? And they just surrendered to you, or what?
No, I don't understand that whole thing there. But when we got the two, the other ones, that had happened before that. But then when the last two we had, and we had a firefight with them, and then we brought one of them back.
And that sure sounds like a situation where it was going to either be you or them.
Yeah, it did. It would. You're out in the woods, middle of the woods, nobody's around. Whoever gets the fire done right wins, and that's what happened.
Is there an emotional or mental weight that comes along with that situation when you realize that the bullets you guys were firing claimed the life of an enemy?
It was. And you always think about one didn't make it. You always wonder about him. He's somebody else, you know, fighting a war, has a family. You think about those things.
Date-wise, mid-January, that must have been toward the tail end of the Battle of the Bulge, huh?
Yeah, it was. The 84th Infantry Division had been transferred south to the Battle of the Bulge. And then when the Battle of the Bulge was over, then we were transferred back to the northern sector up right against the British. The lieutenant in charge of our platoon particularly got the staff sergeant and I and told him that they were having applications for people that wanted to go to OCS in France. And so the staff sergeant and I thought, well, you know, it sounds like a good opportunity. And so we applied and they approved our transfer. And so then we were transferred. It was around Krefeld, Germany is about as far as I got. Oh, and then one thing that during this time that was sort of family, one of my brothers was, he had joined the Army and joined the 9th Army headquarters in Presidio, San Francisco. And in that 9th Army headquarters, they had no units, no divisions or anything, but the 9th Army then was sent overseas. They were in, 9th Army was in charge of the 84th Infantry Division. So a couple of times that when we were off the line and we'd go back for rest and relaxation, I got to go back and see my brother at 9th Army headquarters, and that was good.
What a treat.
Yeah, and to see my brother, yeah.
I
also saw, after the war, my other brother was in Italy. They had compassionate leave, and you could visit family relatives in the area, and so I put in and spent a week with him in Italy. He was in the Air Corps at that time.
When you're that far away from home and you see a familiar face like that, how do you guys spend your time? What kind of stuff do you talk about?
Oh, talk about our experiences and what they've been doing and what's happened at home and that sort of thing. Really good to have the feeling again, back with my family again.
Timeline-wise, when was it that they sent you to France for OCS?
I don't remember. I think it was a six-week course. We were almost through about 2 weeks after the war that we finished school. We graduated and were commissioned.
So VE Day happened 2 weeks before you got your commission. So you must have left your unit somewhere around early April or something like that, which is right before your unit liberated a couple concentration camps. I'm sure there are other combat situations. Do you ever wonder if heading off to OCS could have saved your life?
I thought about that, yeah. And it's always part of our thinking at the time. You know, if you want to go to school, get out of combat, and decided, yeah, that's a good idea. So that sergeant and I decided that's what we wanted to do. So we did.
So when that news comes that Germany has surrendered, you're in France in school, and I imagine that was some pretty welcome news.
Oh, it was real welcome. But then everybody said, well, where are we going now? And big talk about Japan, you know, the East, and probably that's where we would be going.
Yeah, now you're going to be an officer, so you're going to have a lot of responsibility and other lives in your care, you're probably thinking.
Oh, yeah, it'd be a platoon leader, probably. It was an infantry, and I'm sure it would be the infantry.
And I don't want to get it wrong, you tell me, but it sounds like if those bombs hadn't have been dropped, you might have been leading an infantry platoon into Japan.
Oh, sure. I'm sure that's where we would, because they would, we're going to need plenty of people if they're going to invade Japan. I ended up in what was called, that was their name, 1313th Labor Supervision Company in Mannheim, Germany. Mannheim was nothing but rubble. This was really a POW. They were prisoners of war in this camp. They called it labor supervision because all those POWs were sent out every day working in Mannheim to clean up all the debris and trying to begin the reconstruction of the whole town. And there were, I think, around 400 people that lived there. They were prisoners. And they had officers, German officers. We worked with the German officers most of the time. But we were probably five people in charge of that unit. We had our own quarters and had a German woman they furnished the food, and she did the cleaning and cooking for our unit.
How long were you there?
9 or 10 months. And I'd have enough points to go home. That was another thing, that as a sergeant, I would have had enough points to go home. But when I became an officer, I'd have enough points to go home.
I was just thinking that as you were saying that. Here you've got the Bronze Star, which is extra points. You've been over there all this time. If you had ridden it out, you could have gone home and seen your wife, but who knows if you would have survived.
Oh, yeah.
So you go to OCS, but now you're stuck there for almost another year?
Yeah, I was there for about a year. Then I started the process of going home. This was in 46. And of course, my wife, she was very disappointed that I didn't get to come home in 45.
Everybody else is coming home.
Everybody's going home, you know. Oh, yeah. Well, why can't you go home? Well, I don't have enough points.
But that duty for 9 or 10 months, as you said, supervising some of the guys that you used to be fighting, some of the guys could have been the guys shooting at you. That's and right. Killing your friends. Did you get a different perspective about the German people, or at least the German military, from working with those prisoners?
Well, we really didn't have much contact with them. Of course, I didn't speak German. Anyway, we dealt mostly with their own officers there. And I think a lot of them could have gone home, but a lot of them didn't have homes to go to, didn't know where homes were, and lost their family and the conflict and everything. So you think about them a lot and what they're going through. They're sort of glad the war is over, I think.
Well, and that is a major distinction that I think a lot of times we don't consider, because we think about all the American servicemen coming home. If they were fortunate enough to come home, they did have a home to come home to, where the people on the other side largely didn't. When you finally did get to come home and see your wife again 3 years later, more than 3 years after you guys got married, what was that like?
Oh, that was great, yeah. I was discharged in Camp Beale in Northern California, and she was there, and that was great. You know, you dream about that and think about going home all the time. And when it happens, it's a great feeling. You're back home, back to family again.
In all those nights that you were overseas, those nights where you're freezing in a foxhole and shivering and trying to stay dry and not die from the elements, and the tree bursts are going off or the rifle fire's coming in, whatever the things may be. In all that time over there, were there days or nights where you wondered, am I ever going to see Irene again?
Oh, sure. You'll think about that. But that's a fact of life when you're in a situation like that where your life could go at any time. And so you get used to being aware of that, and you learn to live with that. It's not good, but it's there all the time. You always think about that.
And four of you Parker boys went over, and all four came back, huh?
And all four came back, yeah. And I got to see my two brothers over there, got to see Miller twice, and Dick down in Italy. He was in Ordnance Air Corps. But I never did get to see Jim until I came home, and he had been discharged too. But all of us came home. And I was the only one in combat. And Miller was, he had push job. He's in Ninth Army headquarters. And Dick did too. He was in charge of a depot for bombs and ordnance.
Is that something that you talked about when you got back? Or is that something that you just kind of filed away because you were so happy to be back with Irene and ready to actually have a life?
We talked it over, my brothers and I. And we did that overseas. Yeah. When I got to see my brother Miller and Dick down in Italy. But then when we came home, we all, you know, exchanged experiences we had and grateful that all four of us got to come home. I got out in 46, came home in August, and my wife was living in Bakersfield with her family. So we got an apartment, and I enrolled in Fresno State in the GI Bill, and they paid me to finish my last year of college. And so I graduated in 47.
And you became a public accountant and did that for decades, and the farm that your father had started out here in La Grande, California, is still in the family. And we can go to a farmer's market any weekend and buy some Shasky Farms nuts?
Yeah, that's from the farm my dad bought in 1942. Family again.
Yeah.
They're still living there. We've got one, two, three, four. I guess there's four families living there on the property now.
It's such a small world. One of the guys running that farm used to be my next-door neighbor in Las Banas, and his brother is the one I see selling the nuts at the farmer's market. If you see an upside-down sign, it's a trick. He's trying to get you to come buy his walnuts and almonds there.
That's Tom.
Small world. I've got to ask you, and if there's anything we left out, I hope you'll share anything that's relevant to you. But I've got to ask you about going on the honor flight from here in California all the way to Washington, D.C. to visit that World War II memorial that was paid for by World War II veterans. I mean, it was private money raised to put it there. It's there to honor 406,000 guys who were a lot like you but didn't get to come home. What was that experience like for you?
It was a great experience. And I was amazed at the emotions I felt there at the memorial for World War II. I think the water fountains had a lot to do with that. I couldn't understand why the water, it brought the whole thing to life, is what it did. And that was a great addition, but the memorial was great. Everything's first class. We got to stay in good hotels, good food. We enjoyed that.
Uh-huh. And who went with you?
My grandson. He was good help. And, that was a great experience for him.
You know, I don't think I've ever heard anyone say that the water brought it all together. But that makes sense because that sound is always there and there's some movement there and there's some life to it. And it's juxtaposed against that backdrop. If you stand on the right side, you'll see the water in the foreground, and right behind it, those 4,000 gold stars that represent over 400,000 Americans who died. When you looked at that, freedom wall, as they call it there, what went through your mind?
Well, emotional. I get really emotional there. And also at the Vietnam Memorial was very emotional, too. But they were those. You think of all the tragedies and the lives that were lost and interrupted and changed. It was a great experience. But I think the water made a big difference. It brought the whole thing to life.
And it sounds like you added a little water to it.
Yeah, I did. Very emotional.
And I wouldn't be surprised if your grandson did either, because, as you say, those were lives interrupted, but they also represent lives that never occurred. And your grandson wouldn't have been born if you didn't make it home.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Is that something that sinks in? If you look, your two children, your two grandchildren, you ever look at them and say, man, if one of those tree bursts had hit me instead of the guy over there, they wouldn't be here?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, think about that. Yeah, it's at times very emotional. Yeah, you got two grandchildren, and hopefully we'll have great-grandchildren.
Yeah. And you had 70 years of marriage with Irene until you lost her in 2013. Was it hard to get used to being a civilian again after all that time in uniform?
I remember my wife, I didn't have PTSD. I didn't have that. But particularly at sleeping, I would, have nightmares and throw my arms around. And I don't think I ever yelled or anything, but I did. I think a lot of people experience that too. Hard to sleep, you remember things. And even today, loud noises are real sudden loud noises. That really make me, I react to that.
Have you ever found anything that helps with that?
No, not much. Prayer is good. Prayer helps. Yeah, depend on the Lord to help you through those things. Yeah, and he did help me through combat. And that's a hard thing to know, because there are a lot of people who are, believers and so on. But at least he helped you get through that. I would like to say, oh, he saved my life, but why didn't he save everybody's life? Why didn't he save my friend's life? It's one of those things. But the Lord helps you get through those things.
Well, if there's anything else that's important to you, I'm all ears, but I don't want to forget to thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for sharing your story with us. Is there something that you look back on, maybe when you see that bronze star on the wall, or you see the combat infantry badge that's under it, or you look at that familiar axe in the wood of the rail splitters logo? Is there something when you look at those that you feel most proud of or most thankful for?
Proud, because I did serve, and honorably served, 3.5 years, apart from family, apart from wife. Just appreciate all that and appreciate the opportunity to serve, even though it was dangerous duty.
And I mentioned when we started that you are still in the same house that you started living in 1949 here in Merced, California. This city's changed a lot over those years, a lot more people here now. But I think one thing that stayed the same is you're flying that flag outside, and I see the stars and stripes when I walk up. Why do you do that? What does that mean to you?
Well, that means a lot to me. It's a family, it's the country that we represent, and it's an honor to fly the flag, an honor to acknowledge the gift that we have here in this country and freedom, great country. And we run into problems now, but I'm sure that some way we'll survive and we'll be greater in the future. I really think we will. People just need to understand that the nation is greater than some of the problems that we are encountering. If we can ever get past the political bickering, almost hatred between the different factions, the two different political parties, I think eventually we will and be a better country for it. But we have to go through what we're going through in order to get there.
Wisdom and perspective from a 98-year-old World War II veteran. That's John Parker of Merced, California. If you want to put a face with that youthful and energetic voice you heard, pull up the photos on Facebook. Just punch in Hometown Heroes Radio or head over to hometownheroesradio.com. And join us again next time when we're reminded once again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.